welcome to episode 19 of Girls on Pop. I am your co-host, Brain Antunes, joined today by fellow co-host.
And I'm Ashley Lynch.
We're back, and we're going to jump right in, because so are the movies.
Back, baby.
You know, it's the summer. We've been trying to get away as much as we can. And we've managed so far to do a pretty good job of getting away at least once a month for a couple of days. So, sorry. Awesome. Sorry, internet. Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, no, I got away for some time, too. And it's like, it definitely makes recording this show a little bit more kind of sporadic and off the cuff, maybe more than even we'd like. But at the same time,
it's nice to unwind.
Exactly.
I haven't taken like a proper vacation, like where you're away and not doing anything for years. And we were in the middle of a provincial park where there was absolutely no cell phone signal. So I literally couldn't even check email. I couldn't text anybody. And I kind of loved it. Nice. I came back and I'm like, I'm just going to start leaving my phone at home occasionally.
I did that exact same thing last year, where back in October of last year, I rented out a cabin in a little bit like further in like near Golden, BC. And it was so far kind of off the grid that you could not get cell service there. And I did basically my one thing that I had on my bucket list. I wanted to go spend a week in an old remote cabin with no one around, with a manual typewriter and a bottle of whiskey, and polish off a screenplay. And that's exactly what I did.
It also sounds like a horror movie in the making.
I know. There was like at night, I would kind of like just like, I'm alone in this cabin and it's night. And I would start to imagine, what if like a guy in a hockey mask just showed up, because I'm a child of the 80s and that's where my brain goes. But no, I got used to it. It's like after a week of that, part of me was just like, screw civility. I'm just going to like do this forever. And I'm never going to see another human being again. And it's going to be great.
Well, we weren't quite that remote, but we were camping. And I have to say, as much as the camp showers are great, there's nothing like standing underneath a hot shower for like 10 minutes after you've sort of like doing the quick 2-second rinse. It's nice to be back to civility, but itching to go back. There was more camping left for the year. But not talking about camping, we're talking about movies. And our return coincides, sort of, with the return of the movies.
Yeah, movie theaters are back, at least like specifically in Canada, where we are. Movie theaters have opened back up and are starting to welcome people back. And have you gotten out to like an actual proper theater yet?
Nope.
So I did. I went back to a theater for Fast and Furious 9. And I was very kind of like hum and haw about it. But there's a local theater near me that's very much in kind of like a aging hipster type of, you know, boomer community. It's very respectful. They don't allow anyone under 18 in, because it's all drink service inside there as well. And it's like, it's a very polite audience that's there. It's like, okay, I'm going to go there. And I took a look. It's like when you order, you know, reserve your tickets, it's like I can see how much the theaters have filled up. And that's when I discovered what at least Cineplex is doing, is that on the app, when you select your seats, it blacks out everything around you within a certain radius to maintain social distancing, which was really nice. So like opening weekend, Fast and Furious 9, there was maybe 15 people in the theater. So it was a very kind of controlled and subdued environment, which made me feel very kind of like at ease and not all that worried about it. But just like going up to the concession and like getting some popcorn and whatnot. And the guy behind the counter asked me, do you have your scene card? And I just got all giddy, because I'm like, oh my God, no one's asked me for my scene card in over a year. I can't tell you how long I've waited to hear someone ask me for my scene card. I had an emotional moment just being back in the theater. It was awesome. I don't know how kind of much I'm going to do it, how sporadic or not my attendance is going to be. It's probably going to depend on the movies. But like the, you know, couple weeks later, we went to the drive-in, and you know, that feels like a much more kind of contained situation. But I think things are going to get better, especially now that I've gotten my vaccine. So I'm feeling a lot more kind of secure and safer.
I actually had a small, like it was, I think it was a legit panic attack, because I had looked at the Vancouver International Film Center, which is where the local film festival runs out of. They've done a renovation during the pandemic. They had been planning on this for a while, and I guess since they had to close, like, now is as good a time as any to do the renos. So they've expanded, they've sort of changed their lobby, and now they have, in addition to their theater, they have a small screening room that seats, I think, like 40 people. And it's almost finished. And so they're going to open in August, and their opening night film is Annette, which just caused a huge ruckus at Cannes. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, maybe I'll go and see this. It'll be like more than 4 weeks since my second dose. I'll feel okay. So before I bought the tickets, I messaged my movie buddy, Melissa. I'm like, so do you want to go see this? She's like, well, I'm actually out of town. And as soon as I hit send on the text message, I'm like, this was a bad idea because I'm already feeling nervous about going into a theater and I haven't even bought a ticket yet. So when she said no, I was kind of like sigh of relief. And now I'm like, I don't know. I didn't realize I would feel this anxious about the return to the theaters. I mean, I'm going to go back for sure. But I honestly, at this point, feel that I'm going to be watching like 3 movies in the theater. And the first one is probably going to be Dune. And the second one is probably going to be Top Gun. And that might be it for me. Like, I was already... like, I love the movies, but I was already reluctant about movie theaters. I don't like the crowds. I don't like the audiences. For the most part, I find them really disrespectful. I can't deal with people talking. People with their phones are like a nightmare. I wish there was like this blackout thing over theaters where when you walk in the door, that's it, your phone is fucking dead, because it just drives me insane. And I'm such a picky, picky person when I go to the theater. So I tend to go, like, Dan and I usually go like the first show of the day because everybody is still sleeping. And I can usually get away with watching a movie without like getting infuriated by somebody. But I just have my fuses like this short now. So I was already kind of like, I hate people. And the experience of the movies can be really, really difficult at times. So when the pandemic happened, I'm like, you know, I'm kind of okay with avoiding the movies for a while. But I mean, I do miss it because I do love the movies and I love seeing them on the big screen. And there's nothing like being immersed in a universe. I'm like, now it's the double thing of, do I trust humanity to have been vaccinated and not be spreading around all their germs? And do I really want to deal with like rude people again?
I mean, you don't even trust them to not use their phones.
Well, this is it. So I'm kind of like, I don't know. I'm definitely going to go back, but I am in no hurry to go back. I mean, if Dune opened next week, I would be going to the movies next week.
And I agree with every one of your complaints about the movie theater. I share them as well. But at the same time, the experience of just going to the movie theater and getting a big bag of popcorn, yep, and sitting there and watching it on the screen, having a shared experience,
yes,
of that film with other people, it is prime optimal condition. There's absolutely nothing that beats that. And
I agree.
All of the detriments, which are very real, and like I say, I agree with every one of your complaints, it's not enough to keep me away from movie theaters. I will be going to movie theaters for as long as they're around.
I'm
with
you.
Magical to me. I still, yeah, feel like a child when I go to a movie theater.
I'm more selective now than I ever had been. Like even before the pandemic happened, I was starting to get very selective about the movies that we saw on the big screen, and it was usually like the event films. Summer, spring, summer, autumn. And then there were like some movies that for whatever reason I'd want to see on the big screen. But a lot of the time I was opting to skip the big screen experience to watch something at home because I just didn't want to deal with the people and it didn't feel like it was necessary. But I mean, there are some stuff that I still, you know, I mean, I'm always going to go back. And like I said, if Dune opened tomorrow, I'd be at the fucking theater tomorrow. Give me Top Gun, no problem. I will be there tomorrow. But
And I'm someone who's done as much as they can to recreate the theatrical experience at home. I have a big screen 4K TV. Yep. I have 4K Blu-rays that I can watch. I have a movie theater popcorn machine in my house because I freaking love movie theater popcorn. So I can have that whenever I want. It's like I can replicate the theater experience from the comfort of my home. But there's something different about going out to a public place and having that shared experience.
For sure. And I mean, I am going to go back sooner rather than later. I think I will go to the Van City at some point to watch some stuff for sure. And the movies are calling to me. There is other stuff that I'm really excited about. And I am looking forward to, like, one of the things that I really love doing is going to the movies with friends. You know, you go for dinner, you go to a movie, you talk about it afterwards. You know, that's, there's, like you say, I mean, even if we watch it in my living room, it's not the same. So I will go back, and I'm happy that they're back, and I'm happy that things are progressing. And I like the fact that, you know, so for, at least at the moment, there's still quite a bit of space between people. So maybe now is the time to go to the movies when there's only 15 people in the theater.
Because, like, right now in the States, they've done away with the social distancing in theaters. So they're back to packing the house as full as they can. And, you know, let's be real. We are not out of pandemic. So it's like, if the theater was, like, full of wall-to-wall people, I would be more reluctant to go. No. It is actually the social distancing that Cineplex is doing right now that has made me feel comfortable with it. So my next time back in the theater is probably going to be for Suicide Squad, because I want to see that one. So
yeah, I might make the trip.
But that segues into our news item. And
yes,
is that not only are movie theaters back, but audiences are back. Like, very most specifically, Marvel's recent movie that they held on to for a long time, Black Widow, did phenomenally at the box office. It had $80 billion for the opening weekend, which is low for opening weekend in before times, but it is a new record for post-pandemic opening weekend. Yeah. And that's in conjunction with a hybrid release model where they put out a Disney Plus as well.
Yeah,
where I can't remember what it was. They estimated something like about another 40 million worth of viewers on Disney Plus watched it there. So it's movies are being successful again. And we've had movies like that across the board. Fast 9 was successful. Quiet Place 2 was successful. Strangely enough, the winner this weekend seems to have been M. Night Shyamalan's Old, which is doing incredibly well. Small horror movies seem to be doing quite well.
Yeah, well, and I think it's funny because the horror movies always do well. Generally speaking, they tend to play really well. But after the year and a half that we've had, I'm actually quite surprised that they're doing as well.
I think it's a level of catharsis.
For sure. For sure.
It definitely makes me feel better. Like, at the beginning of the pandemic, I think we're all worried, will theaters survive?
Yeah, for sure.
Are they going to go under? And it seems to me right now that the answer is a resounding no, they're going to be around.
Oh, no, for sure. I think what's interesting about Black Widow is not only that it did so well at the box office, but it did so well at the box office despite the fact that it was available for purchase at home at the same time, which has until now been this point of contention with a lot of people. It's like, is this the future? Are we going to get all of the Warner Brothers movies on HBO Max? Are we going to get all the Disney movies on Disney Plus? So, I mean, the model works. At least it's working for now. Whether it works long term, I don't know.
I have a theory that the hybrid release model actually does not shrink the audience, because the fear is that, like, well, if I can see it at home, why am I going to go to the theater? And I'm sure there are some people that are like that. You know, for example, if you have four kids, dragging them to the theater is an extremely expensive proposition, where the one rental fee for Black Widow at home is really just, it's a fraction of what you would pay to have that theatrical experience. But people still went out to the theater to the tune of $80 million worth, which is really good. And I think what's going to happen with the hybrid release models, it's not actually going to shrink the theatrical audience, at least not in any real discernible large way. But I think it's actually going to expand the audience that is going to be willing to see the film, because there's a lot of people. I think the average is like, the average person will see 2 to 3 movies per year in the theater. That's it. There, you know, as opposed to someone like me who will see like 2 to 3 movies a month in the theater. And for all those people who they just don't go into the theater that much, the hybrid release model offers an opportunity for them to actually see these movies. And I think it's going to end up growing the audience, not shrinking it.
I agree. It just expands the conversation, right? The more people that talk about it, the more people that are interested in it, the more sequels you can make, the more money you can generate. It's just like the cyclical, never-ending model. I think you're right. I think it works. And the pandemic has proved that it worked and that it continues to work. So tied into the releases you had tweeted a story last week that I really, really liked, and I wanted to just touch on it. And it was in Entertainment Weekly, The Evolution of Female Superhero Costumes, which I thought was a fascinating read, and nice to see that we're finally moving past the cat suits.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, we've had a lot of female superheroes this year. Black Widow, where we have both, you know, have Scarlett Johansson and Florence Pugh in that movie. And then you've got Loki with the female Loki in that show, and a whole bunch of other characters that have been sort of speckled without. And it was sort of commenting on how we seem to have moved past needing to stick these women in like platform boots and instead letting them like wear normal boots and not having them to have ridiculous costuming.
Impractical.
Yeah. Beyond impractical. Like, yeah. One of the big stories that I remember is from the first G.I. Joe movie that Sienna Miller had to be transported around set laying flat on the back of a flatbed trailer.
Yeah.
Because the corset was so tight,
she couldn't bend.
She couldn't sit.
Yeah.
She was incapable of sitting. So yeah. She had to be transported prone around set and then propped up like a mannequin
because
of how restrictive the costume was.
And that's so ridiculous.
It is. And it's like, I like that we're kind of getting away from that sort of paradigm into something that makes a little bit more sense. And there's going to be people who are going to whine about it. It's like, feminists have ruined my superhero, whatever. I welcome it.
Me too. I thought in addition to that, one of the interesting parts about that article was that they do speak with the costume designers. And there was, even beyond the fact that we're finally moving into some normalcy and some practicality into female superhero costumes, but it's the behind the scenes too. The fact that, you know, you have to design your costume with your actor in mind, and it sometimes you need to customize. Like they were talking about the female Loki. Like she's mom, she was breastfeeding. They needed to do something about the outfit so she could get in and out of it in order to breastfeed and pump. It's like, okay, well, this is the reality of life.
Yeah. I thought that part was incredible. I saw that she like tweeted out that story before, but the actress Sophia DiMartino, and yeah, she's a new mom and she needed to be able to pump. And so they built the costume with these hidden zippers in that allowed her to basically be able to, you know, pump in between shots and whatnot. And it's like, that's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you watch the show and you would never know. It's like, oh, she's got hidden boob zippers.
No, I love it. I love it. And with that, should we talk about some TV? Do you want to start with Black Widow?
We can start wherever you want. But yeah, let's dive into Black Widow.
Because I actually saw this one too. I haven't seen a lot, but I did manage to watch Black Widow. Woohoo for me!
This is one of the ones I went to the drive-in to go see. So yeah, we went there for that experience, which was fun.
I love the drive-in. I try to get out there as much as I possibly can.
I know, it's super fun, and especially like right now, super packed as well. I think the pandemic has been good to drive-ins.
Yes.
And now they're actually finally starting to get like new product. So it's you get out there and it's like the tickets sell out in advance. I had to buy them at the beginning of the week to go out there that weekend. And even then, it was like, God, we should have gotten here earlier.
Earlier. I know. It's never too early to get there. I have to admit, I was not super excited to see this, only because I just don't really care. Like, at this point, it's just another Marvel movie. I should have known better. with Scarlett Johansson and Florence Pugh, I should have known that it would be better than just your average movie. And I really, really enjoyed this a lot. The action sequences are awesome. The storyline is actually really interesting. I really liked the spy Russian Cold War vibe it had going. I was all in. Loved it. Fabulous.
One of the things that kind of took me aback about Black Widow was I realized as the movie started, and it was kind of catching me off guard with the story that they were telling, that for the first time in a very long time, I was watching a Marvel movie where everything didn't feel like a known quantity. I didn't know what to expect. It's like, well, it's a Black Widow movie. It's going to be like espionage, and you know, it's going to be along those lines, and there'll be some fun action. That's about it. I was not ready for this entire The Americans plot with this family, with, you know, Father David Harbour and Mother Rachel Weisz and and Sister Florence Pugh, where they are all, they're not a real family. They are just Russian plants who start off pretending to be an American family, and then the mission ends and they kind of get separated and go on their ways, and they come back together again. And they form more or less a real, genuine family, even though they were always a fake spy family. And I found that incredibly endearing, and I was not expecting that as a story. I was not expecting the film to go to so many ostensibly dark places, but handle them with enough tact that it felt family friendly, because it's literally about trying to like storm a base of child abuse, where they kidnap children and turn them into weapons against their will. And, you know, it's like, it, give all these women hysterectomies, and it's like, this is some dark shit. It's in the Marvel universe, and I think they handle it quite well. And it ends up being an incredibly fun little movie. And also just have a movie that doesn't feel like it's connected to too much, because it is a prequel. It takes place before, or I think like just after the events of Civil War, and right before Infinity War. And you can tell this because of the different hair dye jobs that she has at the beginning of the end of the movie. That's how it synced that up.
I actually didn't realize. I did know that it fell kind of in between the two, because clearly she's dead now. This was like the prequel after she was dead, and I knew that was a big deal. But honestly, if I didn't know that, I wouldn't have been able to know where it falls into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I have no idea.
Yeah, they kind of let you know at the beginning it takes place after Civil War. And it's like some fallout from that. And then at the end of the movie, it's like she just has blonde hair now. And it's like, oh, okay, she's going off to Infinity War now, because that's when I saw her have blonde hair. And then the other thing that it sets up is that, you know, Florence Pugh is going to be continuing on in this universe. Essentially, I think taking Scarlett Johansson's place, because I think at this point she's done with these movies. I think she's kind of like aged out of it. It's time for new blood. And Florence Pugh is a lot of fun in this movie.
She's super talented.
More than I know that she's a great actress, but I was not expecting her to be so fun in an action movie.
Yeah.
And like, and even making fun of like some of the tropes.
Yeah.
Of Black Widow. Like there's a point where she like jumps out of a ceiling grate.
Yeah.
And lands in like the Black Pit of, like, you know,
the move,
hand planted, leg spread sort of like pose. And then she makes fun of it immediately. Like, oh, that's lame. I'm never doing that again. Sort of thing. It's like, okay, I like this. Yeah, and clearly she's going to be continuing on. It sounds like she's going to be in the Hawkeye series when that comes out.
I was actually kind of surprised that Kate Shortland had this in her. I've seen the majority of her work over the years. For those that haven't seen Somersault, it's the introduction of Abbie Cornish, who was really good at the time. I'm not sure what's happened to her career since, but she showed great promise, and that movie is fantastic. But I really didn't think that she had this in her, so it was a nice surprise.
That's part of the Marvel machine. Like, I know that they have that to a certain degree, where they bring in directors and they say, what you need to do is you need to work with the story, you need to work with the actors. Don't worry about the action, don't worry about the effects, because we have the people who do that. And they bring in the stunt choreographers who work out the cool fight scenes, and they bring in the VFX department that does previs on all the action scenes. And it's possible for directors who maybe aren't as skilled in those areas to basically sit back and let these skilled department heads do their job. Or they can get involved and, you know, tweak it as much as they want. But it's like you can say that that's like a kind of like soulless sausage machine. To a certain degree it is, but like all movies are to a certain degree. But also these are people, you know, professional teams who are operating at the top of their game. They're the best at what they do in this industry. And the results speak for themselves. Black Widow has some great action scenes in it.
Yeah.
They're super fun.
Well, and I mean, honestly, if you're going to be the mindless sausage machine, it's better to do it this way, where you have directors that are more focused on character and story than directors that are more focused on action and great effects and can't direct an actor. So for me, this is much better option, and it seems to be working much better. So what's next?
Let's see. So next, well, let's go with what I saw as the double feature at the drive-in.
Oh,
before Black Widow. I got to see Cruella.
Oh, nice!
New live action villain origin, which I have been resisting for a long time because I am not a fan of Disney's whole let's do live action remakes of animated movies. I'm not a fan of their whole let's take all the villains in our old animated movies and go, but really they're misunderstood. Really, don't you want to know the story about why this woman wants to kill puppies? Like, no, not really. I don't. And so I was, you know, kind of like ideologically against this movie from the very beginning. But I had a lot of people who I trust quite a lot telling me, no, it is actually good, actually. And so I was like, okay, fine. It's playing before Black Widow. We're going to go see Cruella. Despite having a very ridiculous opening, which suggests that basically Dalmatians killed her mother and that's why she is the way she is. I mean, whatever. I don't know what a good origin for that character is that works. And so they went with one that was ostensibly silly, and it's there. But the whole rest of the movie ends up being almost like a Devil's Wear Prada type of film, where you have the character of Cruella basically, like, I don't want to say in disguise, but she's basically like, she has her normie mode where she's trying to like blend into society and trying to make it in the fashion industry and working for a fashion mogul played by Emma Stone, or sorry, not played by Emma Thompson, who does a fabulous job at playing like an absolutely like detestable character in this film. And the whole film is like sort of like a tete-a-tete between these two characters, between like, you know, this titan of the industry and this subordinate who wants to like rise up through the ranks. And she finds her way to basically combat her rival by adopting the persona of Cruella and taking the fashion industry by storm. And it's actually a lot of fun. There's so much pageantry. The story is genuinely good. I fell in love with the character, and it's a truly enjoyable movie. The only parts where the movie basically falters, in my opinion, is all the times it had to remind me that it's a prequel to 101 Dalmatians. If you made this movie and completely detached it from anything 101 Dalmatians, I would love this movie. I don't know. Have you seen this film yet?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, what did you think?
I really liked it as well. I have some similar complaints. I thought as a backstory, an origin story, it doesn't need to be there. I don't see why it needs to be connected to anything to do with Disney. It could just be a movie and it would be fabulous at that. And I think it stands well enough on its own. I just don't see the point of tying it into, with you, I don't see the point of tying it into 101 Dalmatians. But I love the music. The art design in this movie is awesome. The costumes are amazing. The two Emmas are great together. I think they make wonderful, wonderful dance partners. And they really do have a couple of spur moments that are really fun to watch. And it's much darker than I thought it would be as well. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. I wouldn't see it with my niece, who really wanted to see it. And I'm like, yeah, I think you might be a little too young for this. And I'm glad that we held back, because I think 5 is maybe a bit too young.
I saw it with my 14-year-old and she loved it.
But I think it's definitely better movie than I anticipated it to be. And I recommend it. I thought it was quite good.
That's awesome.
And great soundtrack. Great soundtrack.
Yeah, that was also a thing. It was like very much, yes, I love all the songs that were in the soundtrack, but it was also like very much like a who's who of needle drops.
For sure.
In the film, it was like, some very on the nose stuff. I'm surprised they didn't have, or maybe they did have Sympathy for the Devil played in, and I just don't remember. But yeah, it was, I thought it was some very, very obvious needle drops.
Oh, for sure. For sure, but still a ton of fun.
Absolutely. But speaking of needle drops, let's talk about Fear Street.
I love it.
So Fear Fear Street is a new 3-movie series on Netflix based on the novels by R.L. Stine, which is basically like, for lack of a better way to put it, a throwback horror series. Did you have any like familiarity with the R.L. Stine?
I know R.L. Stine from when I was an elementary school kid that was obsessed with books. So I did read, I think, the Goosebumps series, and I think I may have read some of the Fear Street, but at some point I aged out of them very quickly. They're all very similar. But I mean, the story, what I thought was interesting was when the first Fear Street dropped, we were out of town and we came back and this is all everybody was talking about. And I'm like the R.L. Stine thing? Like, this is ridiculous. He wrote kids' books. Like, great. Like, if you look at the Fear Street books, I think the scholastic reading level on those is like grade 5 to like 7. So I'm like, seriously, this is a thing people are excited about?
So I never read any of the R.L. Stine books. When I was coming up in school, like if you were one of the cool kids, you were reading Stephen King.
Yeah.
Like people started off with like the adult stuff. By the time R.L. Stine books came out, I was already a little bit too old for them.
Yeah.
So I didn't go back and read any of them. It's like, why am I going to read these young adult horror novels?
When you've already read the reading film.
And I'm reading fucking Clive Barker. You know, it just, mm-hmm. it didn't make sense to me. And so I knew of their existence, but I didn't really have any familiarity with them at all. Other than, I think there was a TV series of Goosebumps for a while that was popular, which I'd never seen. And, you know, that was about the extent of it. And I had the same reaction as like, wait, why is everyone talking about Fear Street like it's legit horror? Because these are YA novels.
Not even YA.
So if this is going to be, if it's an adaptation of Fear Street, then it has to be the most kind of dumbed down PG version of horror. And people are saying, no, it's actually pretty hardcore. And so I finally, after enough people talking about it, because otherwise it probably would have passed me by. I would have ignored it because I have no connection to the books. So I finally started watching it. And yeah, as a horror fan, I'm not going to say that these films are as nasty and gory and violent as the best that the horror genre has to offer for people who are horror fans. But I think it is a great kind of middle ground connective tissue for, like, if you've been watching Stranger Things and you're into that and you want to sort of like grow into some harder horror that's also like a little bit of a throwback, I think Fear Street is actually a really great series for that, because it is violent, it is gory, there is sex, there is drugs, there is profanity, there is nudity. It's like, this is as adult as it gets. I cannot believe that the books actually are anything like this series is. This show goes for it. And there's even a few kills in the show that are like, holy shit, that's as grisly as anything I've seen in any horror movie. Yeah, I think it's legit. Where if you're a hardcore horror fan, I think there's enough here for you to enjoy. And if you are not a hardcore horror fan yet, if you're still a little bit on the lighter side, I think this one offers kind of like a nice little kind of like, you know, fun stepping stone into that world.
That's a really great way to put it. I'm curious, out of the three, which one is your favorite?
God, I don't think you can separate them, because they are all one story. And like once you get through like the third one, so the first one is 1994, and it's very much like in that vein. It's like a Scream type movie where it's like all just bathed in 90s. And like I said, with the needle drops, there are so many songs.
It starts with a needle drop that I went, really?
Yeah.
It had to be this obvious.
To a level that it almost became annoying. And I was like rolling my eyes at the show, which thankfully calms down after a while. But there was one point where it's like going through a high school hallway and it's like literally like one needle drop fades into another needle drop as the camera pans over to a different student. It's like, okay, I've never seen that before, but it was like, it's this, the needle drops in the show are just like off the freaking charts like I've never seen before. But despite that, I really enjoyed it. But like, yes, it's like you have 94 and then you have 1978, which is about as true a Friday the 13th spiritual sequel as you're ever going to see. And then it goes on to 1666, where it basically goes back to the origin of where this whole thing started and loops back around to the spoilers, the last half basically of 1666 loops back to 1994 and finishes off that storyline in present time. So it's really all these three movies, they're one story, and I don't think you can really separate them. It's hard for me to say I like this one more than I like this one. And it's basically tells the story by moving backwards in time, saying, here's a horrible thing that happened. Oh, but this happened before. Here's how it happened before. It's like, oh, but here's how it all started.
Yeah.
Now here's how we can end the cycle. And it ends up being a really kind of ingenious device for telling this sort of story. And a lot of fun.
I like the fact that it ties, it doesn't constrain itself to trying to tell the story in like one movie that's maybe like 3 hours long and doesn't do a good job of it. I haven't seen the last part yet, but of the two that I saw, I actually really prefer the 94 to the 76 version. I don't know why. I kind of started to like, my mind started to wander off partway through the second one. So, but I did really like the preview for the third one. So that's something that we're hoping to watch this weekend. But I really do like the concept, and I'm still rather surprised that this is based on an R.L. Stine series. I'm like, what other things from my like grade 4 reading are they going to adapt next?
I mean, if they do it like this, I'd be all for it, you know, because it's they clearly made the whole their own thing.
And, yeah, for sure.
It's all three movies are directed by Lee Janik, who did the little indie horror film Honeymoon. It sounds like they didn't have a lot of time or a lot of money to do what they did, but it's
they pulled it off.
What they get out of it is
agreed.
It's really well done. It's the best way I've come up with to describe this series is that it is trashy fun in the way that I wish American Horror Story was trashy fun instead of being camp the way that show is camp.
Yeah.
So this show isn't camp, it's trash, but it is a lot, it's very, very fun trash.
Agreed.
And it's kind of what I wish American Horror Story was.
I could go with that. What's next?
So next, what I saw is I watched the Edgar Wright documentary, The Sparks Brothers. Have you seen this
film? I haven't, no, it's on my watch list.
I mean, I will watch anything Edgar Wright does, even
pretty much
a documentary, and like true to form, it is an incredibly entertainingly told documentary with so much like visual flourishes and animation and creative editing, and it's just a wild ride. And the story is basically about two brothers, Ron and Russell Mayle, who started a band called Sparks. And this was back in the late 60s, early 70s that they started making music. And apparently these guys have recorded like over 20 albums and are still recording to this day. And they are the type of artist that has influenced all of your favorite artists. And I have never heard of them before. I got 90% of the way through this movie, and I said, I am still not 100% convinced that this isn't a giant Andy Kaufman-esque troll and that these guys don't actually exist. The problem is that there is so much evidence on the internet that they would have had to have retroactively planted to make it look like they actually exist. So these guys actually existed and were tangential to and influential in some of my favorite music that I've ever heard, and I've never heard of them before, and that is so bizarre to me. And that seems to be the reaction of most of the people I know who have watched this documentary, is that they're just like astounded that they have never heard of these guys before. And it's like how that just like collectively slips by everyone's radar, how incredible it is that there's this documentary now, which basically documents their career for everyone to see. So it's like, obviously people should know who these guys are and the music that they've been doing. It is just a wild ride. It was thoroughly enjoyable. I actually can't wait to watch this documentary again.
Oh, that's so awesome. Okay, I have to. I purchased it thinking, okay, I love this guy. I'm sure I'll enjoy the doc. So it's on, literally, it's on the docket to watch, but I didn't even look it up. I honestly don't even know what it's about, but now I'm going to have to definitely move it up on the watch list.
And it's also wild, like, because they go back through all the various, like, performances that they've done through the year, and you hear bits of songs, and you can start to hear that in there. Like, you hear he's got interviews with Duran Duran talking about how they were basically just ripping off the Sparks. and as you listen to the music, it's like, yeah, I can hear the Duran Duran influence in this. I can hear what they were grabbing, and it is freaking wild.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. It's happening. It's happening, yeah. Sooner rather than later. Can you tell me about Gunpowder Milkshake? Because this is another one that I'm like, I should watch this, but every time I watch the trailer, I'm like, maybe not. I don't know. I'm having mixed feelings.
I had the opposite reaction to the trailer. So Gunpowder Milkshake is basically just like a standard kind of assassin does good deed and gets punished for it. And then all the bad guys come after the assassin, and the assassin has to like fend off waves of bad guys type movie. We've seen variations of these. It's John Wick, you know, it's like everything along those lines. But basically it stars Karen Gillan, who is an assassin whose mother abandoned her at an early age, basically like went into hiding, who is also an assassin. The mother played by Lena Headey. And Karen Gillan takes an assignment where, which is going to end in the death of a 10-year-old girl. And she refuses to do it and wants to get the kid to safety. And as a result, manages to screw up the job. And so now the organization that hired her is like, well, you're more trouble than you're worth. We got to take you out, sort of thing. And then she basically gets the help of essentially a group of librarians, which is a front for basically gun runners. So you have these three librarians played by Michelle Yeoh, Carla Gugino, and oh God, I'm blanking on the third one. I'll just have to take the L on that one. And then basically just like wave after wave, guys come in this big shootout in the library and whatnot. It's very kind of standard fare, but it's very kind of like heavily polished and stylized action, which could have been really fun. Unfortunately, it wasn't as fun as I wanted it to be. It's not even so much like the screenplay is what the screenplay is. It was always going to be like, well, it's not going to be incredible, but it's going to be like, you know, fun and entertaining. Visually, it's a delight. The cinematography on this film is incredible. I think the thing that kind of disappoints me the most is probably the editing of the film. Uh-huh. Where I think they made a lot of the wrong decisions in how to edit the action scene. So it actually takes out a lot of the intensity and kinetic nature of it. It's trying very much to do the Hong Kong action thing. It's trying to be very much like a John Woo movie or like
okay, that,
and leans very heavily on slow motion. But it doesn't understand slow motion the way that someone like John Woo would use slow motion to basically accentuate an action beat after the action beat had happened. Instead, it's more like dragging out the action beat as it's about to happen, and we just kind of
it's very Guy Ritchie.
Yeah, it's not as fun as it should be. There's still a lot here that is entertaining. It's an incredibly goofy movie too. It leans very hard on kind of like the outlandishness of this entire world that they've set up, which is fine. It's fun. It's a very inconsequential movie. I love all the actors that were involved with it. And I think they've already greenlit a sequel to it based on the response to the first one. So maybe the sequel, they'll be able to fix some of the problems.
Oh, I'm kind of bummed because I really like the cast.
Yeah, the cast is great. Like anytime you get to see Michelle Yeoh kicking ass is great, you know, and it's especially now that she's moved into a certain age and she's like taking more matronly roles, you know, it's like in movies like Crazy Rich Asians and whatnot. And it's, I remember when you used to like be flying through the air on motorcycles and
yes, right.
And now you're playing mom,
a really bitchy mom at that.
And here you get a chance to see why Michelle Yeoh is who she is. So.
The great Michelle Yeoh.
And Karen Gillan, because anytime you get a chance to highlight Karen Gillan more, especially as a badass, because she's a badass. I am all for it.
How about the movie that took you back to the theaters, F9?
Yeah, so that was the first movie I went back to the theaters for. I don't know, what can you say at this point? I feel like the Fast and the Furious franchise is a known quantity that everyone has like talked to death at this point.
Is it good? Is it as good as the last one? Is it better than the last one? Is it worse than the last one?
It's definitely better than the last one. So I think you have to understand a bit of the trajectory of these movies to a certain degree. So you have the first movie, which is basically just like Point Break, but with like street racers. And then you have the second movie where it's like trying to be like Miami Vice, and they didn't have Vin Diesel back, and it's not that great. And then the series was kind of dying, and then they did this third movie with none of the original cast,
which is the best of the bunch. I will fight people to the death.
Absolutely.
Tokyo Drift is the shit.
And Tokyo Drift is also when Justin Lin comes in and takes over and directs it. And then based off of the unlikely success of Tokyo Drift, they actually put together a fourth movie with all the original cast, which essentially is like a rebooting almost, and doing it as more of an action film than like a Point Break with street racers. And it's okay. It's fine. And then it gets to the fifth movie. And this is where you bring in The Rock as the antagonist. And all of a sudden it's Ocean's 11, but they're driving cars, and you got Gal Gadot in there, and you have all these other like massive cast of characters that they collected throughout the movies. And it becomes this giant telenovela of American action cinema.
Yep.
That is incredibly sincere, wears its heart on its sleeve, has ridiculous convoluted plot lines with characters like, oh, this character didn't die after all. They just have amnesia now. It's literally, we're operating on that level. It is a soap opera, and it is a cheesy-ass soap opera that is not ashamed about what it is.
Yeah,
it's just going to do it straight up. And from there, the movies only get more and more ridiculous. And it just becomes the only rule of Fast and the Furious at this point is that every movie has to be more ridiculous than the last one, while also doing as many cool car stunts as possible. And it's at the point now where it's like you have Kurt Russell playing basically a CIA operative who hires these guys to take on missions that no one else can possibly complete, because what you really need to solve this, like, you know, to stop this James Bond built and with like a world-ending device is a gang of street racers and nothing else.
Oh man, I love it.
So as a trajectory, you have Justin Lin does 3, 4, 5, 6, and then he steps away, and we've got James Wan does 7, and it's pretty good. Maybe not quite as good as when Justin Lin was doing it, but still pretty great. And then you have F. Gary Gray does 8. And this is when things really start to fall apart. And because there was a lot of tensions on set, The Rock and Vin Diesel would not talk to each other. If you watch Fast and Furious 8, they are not in a single scene together.
Yeah.
Even the scenes where they interact with each other, it's like shot, reverse shot, and you have like body doubles. It's like those two guys were not on the same set at the same time. And you also have the loss of Paul Walker, who tragically died in real life. And they basically gave him a happy ending at the end of 7, sent him on his way. And now he's like living on the farm, living his best life in the world of the films. For better or worse, Paul Walker was very much kind of like this empathetic beating heart that was at the core of this series. So 8 has the loss of Paul Walker, has this completely tumultuous set where people aren't talking to each other. And F. Gary Gray just isn't a director that can pull this together in a way that Justin Lin could. So Fast 9, Justin Lin is back, and he is better than ever at doing this sort of thing. He brings the ridiculous action and blends it with an incredibly sincere storytelling of this telenovela action franchise that is incredibly enjoyable. And with like the massive kind of like litany of characters that have been kind of accrued through these films, that's like now you have Helen Mirren in there who's playing Jason Statham's mother and is also a professional thief. It's like, I want that spin-off movie. I want the Helen Mirren professional thief movie. Give me the spy movie with Helen Mirren, where she's like a cougar and she's like dating 20-year-old men that she tosses away like tissue paper. I want that spinoff.
I'll watch that spinoff. Damn it.
And so, like, if you enjoyed the crap that they were doing in 5, 6, and 7, then F9 feels very much like a return to form. And it is very enjoyable, you know? And it is very ridiculous. And it's like, I hate saying this term, but it's very much a turn off your brain and just enjoy it type of film.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that it's fun. I really like Justin Lin. He's made some real snoozers of movies, but generally speaking, when he does action pretty well. And he does have, there is some magic that he brings to a set. Because, mm-hmm. It's not everybody that can pull off this growing cast of characters with these ever more ridiculous stunts. The one thing that I found super endearing about the first 5 movies, I think, by the time you get to number 6, the action sequences start to get so crazy that they have to be mostly CG and not so much practical. But what I liked about the first 5 was that they were very much practical effects, which you don't see on that level anymore in big Hollywood movies. And you can really feel that tactile, like, action. It's gotten to the point now where they're so big you just can't pull all of those off, but there is still the occasional scene that you're like, fuck, they did that in real life, and it's super exciting. I still get really excited about that. So well, I'm really happy to
that's
hear.
That's one of the special things about this movie. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of behind the scenes footage where a lot of the big stunts that they did in this film were practical.
Yeah.
They literally managed to upend and flip over a 10 truck trailer convoy in the air. It just flies up and over end, and they did that practically. They have cars that are basically being pushed through buildings and flying through the air with giant electromagnets, which is a ridiculous device in the film, but it's still a lot of fun. But that's done practically.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of really impressive stunt work on display in this film that I have never seen in any other movie.
No, and I think that, you know, I people are gonna go, what? But I mean, this is on the level of, at this point, James Bond. Like, there are very few films and franchises and just movies in general that are going to this level of, you know, keep it practical. So the fact that they're able to pull this off is always so impressive. And I'm just really happy that this continues, because they're just fun. They're just fun.
That's the only thing that kind of saddens me about, like, the age that we're in, where you see some of these stunts and people just assume that's CG because that's what they're used to.
Yeah.
And when it's a really good practical effect, they just assume it's good CG.
Yeah. I think this is also one of my favorite things about DVD extras and Blu-ray extras, like disc extras, is the behind the scenes making ofs. Like, give me all, like, give me 5 hours of how you did that shot. Yeah. Mission Impossible and, well, Tom Cruise in general does a great job of, like, I'm doing this thing practically. I want you to know we did this. Like, I actually jumped out of the back of the fucking plane. And I love that. Like, because that's the stuff I love to see. And people talk about it, right? Because they're promoting it. The disadvantage with the Fast and Furious franchise is they're not promoting it on that level. The studios are not going, like, this is all practical effects.
Well, there actually was quite a bit of that. Like, Justin Lin in particular was, like, posting a lot of stuff.
That's good, yeah.
Before the release of the movie, showing, like, here's how we did this stunt, here's how we did this stunt sort of thing. And Fast F9 in particular was a kind of a victim of the pandemic, where they had front-loaded all of this advertising for the film and then said, by the way, we're going to stick this on the shelf for a year, year and a half because of the way things are. It was going to come out like a couple weeks before everything locked down. So it was, one of the big problems is, if you haven't seen it yet, do not go and watch the last trailer that was put out for this movie, because my jaw was on the floor when I saw it. I saw it in the theater, and thank God I saw it after I saw F9. But the trailer is beat for beat the final action sequence of the film, just completely laid out, and spoils everything right up to the end of the action sequence. And, like, I have never seen anything that blatant before in a trailer. And I think that's because they needed to come up with new advertising, because they shot their wad when
a year and a half ago
yeah. they came out with all the trailers they were going to come out with, and then suddenly they're
we need more
in the film. It's like, we need something we haven't shown before, and it's kind of disappointing. So if you haven't seen that trailer, do not watch it.
Okay. Not happening. But oh, I'm glad to hear it's fun. It looks like it's one of the big jokes with the Star Trek movie franchise. The original Star Trek movie is like the odd ones are the good ones, or was it the even ones that were the good ones? I don't remember now. But with the Fast and Furious franchise, it's like the odd ones are the good ones.
Yeah.
Generally speaking.
A little bit, yes.
That's so funny. Okay, I'm just going to keep, like, you're going to keep talking because you've seen way more movies than I have. Okay. Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard. Is this any good? Because the title is ridiculous.
So did you see the first
one? I saw the first one and I thought, I liked the first one, but I mean, I like Ryan Reynolds. So. Yeah.
So it all depends on what your opinion is of the first movie. The first movie, of course, being Ryan Reynolds, where he is a protection agency specialist bodyguard. And he is forced to basically get a renowned hitman played by Samuel Jackson to court to basically testify on bad guy Gary Oldman. That's the first film. And you end up with this very kind of like Midnight Run, they're at each other's throat, buddy cop action comedy, which was very ridiculous and in some ways very trite. Feels a little bit like a throwback, but also you have Ryan Reynolds doing his like practically fourth wall breaking, yeah, like snide, snarking, winking at camera sort of like thing that he's
what he's known for.
Yeah, that's his shtick. That's going to be his shtick in every movie from here to the end of his career. He's kind of stuck in that. He's going to do a Deadpool free guy, Hitman's Bodyguard. He's got one character now.
Whatever pays the bills, man.
And let's face it, there's no one who's had more shots at becoming a massive star than Ryan Reynolds.
It's so true. They're
trying to make this guy stick for like 10 years.
Success!
Anyway, so I thought the first movie was a ton of fun. Despite all of its failings, of which there are many, and it was just a good, trashy, fun action comedy that I enjoyed a lot and was dripping with personality. And so I watched the sequel, which, and Salma Hayek is in the first movie, but she's like, spends it entirely in prison. In this one, she's kind of out and with them. And you end up with this kind of trio of banter where she is just batshit crazy in the movie. Ryan Reynolds does not know how to deal with her. Samuel Jackson is like hopelessly in love and will go along with anything she says or does, no matter how crazy. And they're trying to stop bad guy played by Antonio Banderas. And this movie is honestly just as much fun as the first
movie. Oh, that's so good to hear.
Like the first movie, this one is more of the same and is really fun. I enjoyed it a lot. I didn't even realize until it got to like this moment when Salma Hayek and Antonio Banderas were in the room together, even though he's the bad guy and she's ostensibly one of the protagonists. It's like, oh wait, Antonio Banderas and Salma Hayek are back together. I miss seeing them together in scenes before.
Right.
And I watched it with my daughter, and afterwards I was like, I need to show you, like, this is where they met in Desperado.
Desperado's so good.
Some of that, and it was like just wild to like go back to the mid 90s, which is what, 20, how long ago?
A long, long time ago.
And you see what Salma Hayek looks like now, which is incredible. It's like it is a crime for that woman to be that sexy and that funny.
I agree.
And she does not get enough chances.
No, she doesn't.
To show off her comedy in films, but she is so funny in this movie.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear it's good. Oh, great.
I enjoyed her so much. So.
Oh, fun.
Definitely worth it, this movie.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Let's talk about one that I also have seen, The Tomorrow War, which is the Chris Pratt sci-fi action thing on Amazon. I'm curious.
And if you haven't listened to it yet, might be a good chance to go back to a previous episode where we talked about the trailer.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Because we talked a lot about like our expectations of the movie and how the trailer felt like it was promising things that were kind of silly. And we're like, well, we'll wait and see with the movie. Here we are with the movie.
Oh, man. Well, I mean, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. But it also wasn't great. I don't even know what to say at this point. It feels like I know I watched it and J.K. Simmons is like jacked, but I don't actually know. Like the movie is just so bland. Like it's visually uninteresting. The story isn't interesting. Betty Gilpin is wasted. I'm like, why did you just leave her in the present? okay, spoiler alert. I didn't see the twist at the end coming. I was like, oh, okay. So, but until she, it wasn't really at the end even. It was like halfway through the movie.
The last act of the movie.
Yeah. But I mean, it feels like when that happened, I was like, oh, okay, well, I didn't see that coming, but they didn't do anything with it. So yeah. I don't know. The whole thing was just kind of like, sort of like a waste of time.
So when we talked about the trailer, I got really hung up on
the mechanics of the
time travel. Ostensibly a time travel movie that it feels like the answer given in the film by the inherent baked into the cake premise of the film makes absolutely no sense. That there's 100 better solutions than what is being proposed and enacted in this film than what they do. And I had been assured by some people that all those questions and more would be answered in the film. And that actually does make sense. I'm like, okay, happy to be wrong. I sat down to watch it. I was not wrong. This movie does not make one goddamn lick of sense. It is so ridiculous. It opens with during a football game, soccer game. Can't remember some sports
game. Yeah, football game. European football.
So basically a giant explosion of light happens and through a portal step a bunch of teenagers who say, we're from the future and we just need to conscript everyone to go fight a war that we're losing. And apparently every government in the world says, okay, and gives them total authority to just draft citizens around the world and ship them off to the future to fight aliens because that's realistic. No, I don't buy that for a second. And they try to get around some convoluted mechanics by they're only sending people who have already died
in the future.
So they're not creating a time paradox or something. They explain that they managed to get the time thing working, but really janky and held together with chicken wire and duct tape. Okay, whatever. But still, a better solution is come back to the past and solve the problem that caused the war in the first place, not ship off soccer moms to the future to die in a war you're losing. It makes no sense at all.
Don't squint too much. Just don't squint at it.
And the movie doesn't get better from there.
No, I mean, I thought I did like some moments. There are actually some of the fight sequences, which I thought were really, really well composed. And there were some really great ideas. But I mean,
the alien design was really cool. I like that.
I did. I was going to say that too. I mean, I did like the alien design. I like the way they move through the screen. And there is a feeling of urgency. These things are unkillable. And I kind of dug that. It felt silly to chalk it all up to global warming and the melting ice caps that these things had been here forever. And now
that's the bigger problem of the story.
Yeah.
So basically, the third act, they come back.
It's just a mess.
And they learn these things came out of the polar ice caps when they melted. And then that's how they didn't come from space. They were here all along. Which is fine if you want to go that route. But the problem is, and you sort of look back and go, oh, they were trying to do a climate change analogy all along. That's why you have this sort of thing parents being sent off into the future to see the world that they've created for their children where everything is horrible. And it's but if you don't let us know that allegory until the third act,
you've already lost me. That's exactly it.
And it's already this is the type of screenplay where you have in the first act, Chris Pratt is a high school chemistry teacher, and there is this one kid in the class that he makes fun of because the only thing this kid cares about is conspiracy theories about volcanoes, a totally normal thing for any teenager. Conspiracy theories about volcanoes. Gee, I wonder if that's going to come back at some point.
Right.
Lo and behold, when they come back from the future and they find out that where the aliens coming from had something to do with conspiracy theories about volcanoes, they have to go to this teenage kid who opens up the whole thing and solves the problem that no one else could figure out because they just need the one kid in high school with conspiracy theories about volcanoes. It's this is the type level of writing that this film is operating on.
Yeah.
It's not even a shut your brain off and go with it. It's a try not to kill yourself by rolling your eyes too hard.
It's true. It's just a mess. I really can't find myself recommending this at all.
My best way of summing up the movie is I watched the entire film with an expression on my face that just said, the fuck? That's the movie.
I love it. Oh, man. What else do you got?
Let's see. What else did I watch? I watched Werewolves Within. Have you seen this movie or heard anything about
it? So I'm looking rather confused because I think I've seen the trailer, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, so a little bit of backstory. Ubisoft, the video game publisher, has really thrown itself into film production and wanting to take responsible for production of films based on their property. And even though it's a game that not many people have played because it was like a VR party game, but there's a game, Werewolves Within, that Ubisoft owned that they decided, we're going to make this into a movie? Okay. I think it's just like, here's a thing we own. How can we make films out of it? And this is the one that managed to like escape from the farm first sort of thing. And Werewolves Within, it's basically, it's like a, it's, you know, a hidden werewolf sort of game. Like these types of card games that you can play where basically you have, everyone is dealt cards. Everyone is either a villager or a werewolf. And you have the one person who's the werewolf. And then after a round of turn, you have a chance, if you're the werewolf, to basically, like, kill one of the villagers. And everyone has, like, these kind of set questions to try to pose to other people to try to figure out who's the werewolf and who's the villager. And once you figure out who's the werewolf, you go, okay, we're going to, like, kill them. And then you see if you're right or not. And it basically becomes a game of how good can you lie to your friend, which is the best kind of game. And so it's that type of game. Which is a very classic game, and Werewolves Within was just a kind of popular VR version of that game. So they've made a film out of this, and you have Sam Richardson, who was also in The Tomorrow War, but is much better utilized here, and it's very entertaining, is this new park ranger who comes to this small kind of mountain town where you meet everyone in the town. They're all incredibly quirky, weird people, and there's this conflict set up straight from the start, and they keep it very contemporary, where you have essentially like liberals and conservatives in this town, and they're fighting over the fact that there is an oil pipeline that someone wants to basically run through the town. And there's like half the town is for this and the other half the town is against it. And you already have this like conflict between people that's built through that. And then people start dying. You have Sam Richardson trying to solve it and keep everyone together, and everyone's losing their minds and everyone's accusing each other of being the killer. And it starts to become clear. It's like, oh, a werewolf or someone trying to like make it look like a werewolf is killing. And it ostensibly becomes like a comedic who is the werewolf movie. The best way I can describe this movie is it's like a spiritual successor to Clue. It has that same kind of manic comedic energy with larger than life characters that are fraught in crisis and are all at each other's throats, and is at its heart a mystery about who the killer is. And it is like Clue. That's what this movie is. And it has a great supporting cast. It's really funny. It's wildly entertaining, and it was so good. This might potentially be technically the best video game movie to be made yet.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah. So I cannot recommend Werewolves Within highly enough. Like it doesn't bear any resemblance to that game, but you know, except for like the basic premise of like people accusing each other to try to find out who the werewolf is, and they essentially took that and they made a horror movie of Clue.
That's awesome. Okay, I may have to.
Great. I highly recommend this one.
Okay, going on the watch list. I did watch a couple of things. I say reluctantly because I'm not 100% sure why I decided I needed to see this, because I have my love-hate relationship with Guy Ritchie, and he's been mostly on the hate pile for a bunch of years now. But I did watch Wrath of Man because somebody along the line had said that it wasn't so bad, and I'm happy to report it's actually pretty decent. It's not even that it's...
I did see this too.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, like, yeah. It's not like it's... I wouldn't even say it's half bad. I actually think it's like a good movie. It does have, I find that it suffers from the Guy Ritchie third act problems, but generally speaking, I enjoyed it far more than I thought I would. And I actually thought it was pretty well done. It feels a little hoity-toity on itself with its like interstitial titles to subdivide the three parts of the story. It just feels like we're very posh. We've got these fancy titles. Mm-hmm. But like generally speaking, I actually thought it was pretty well done. And I did actually like the way the story unfolds with its back and forth storytelling, and the editing I thought was pretty good. And Jason Statham actually like totally sells it, man. He did. I thought it was pretty decent.
I liked it quite a bit too. And like, I'm the same way with you with Guy Ritchie, where it's like, for the most part, I think Guy Ritchie is, I don't want to say overrated, because there are some things he does really good, but he's also got a lot of shit in his films that feel like enormous baggage that get really hard to get across. And this film has some of that too. He hasn't escaped some of the overt misogyny that's in his films. It's like, I had like a very kind of 14-year-old boy mentality about it with some of the characters, which is gets kind of annoying, and it's like, I wish this movie were more mature than this. But at the same time, Wrath of Man is just a incredibly mean, vicious little crime film.
It is.
In the way that you kind of expect like 70s crime films to be mean and vicious. That's a subgenre that I particularly love. Like, I love the Parker novels by Richard Stark, which, like, the first Parker novel, The Hunter, has been adapted a bunch of times into Point Break, originally with Lee Marvin, and then Payback with Mel Gibson. There was actually an adaptation of one of the novels in that series quite a few years ago, just called Parker, which had Jason Statham in the title role, which is pretty good. It's not great, but it's a pretty good adaptation of the books. And so it's like these really kind of like hard and fast and mean, you know, kind of crime stories. And I really enjoy that. I like movies that have a mean streak every now and then and put you into a world of just like horrible people. And this is one of those movies. And it's like, I thought it was really entertaining. And I agree with you. I think the structure of how they unfold things, because it's a sort of movie where it's like, okay, we're going to show you this, but now we're going to like rewind to like 6 weeks ago to show you like why this is a thing. And we're going to bounce back and forth a bit between timelines. And it creates context that you wouldn't have otherwise that started to make what ostensibly seems like a very simple revenge storyline feel a lot more kind of nuanced and interesting with some fraught conflicts between characters in there. I really dug it. I don't think it's incredible. I'm not sure I'll ever watch it again. Maybe I will, but I thought it was a nice little hard crime film.
Agree. Solid. I also watched Pig, the Nicolas Cage. I felt victim to expectation because I assumed that this would be in line with the Nicolas Cage films from the last couple of years, which have been either batshit crazy or Nicolas Cage being like total asshole, like action to the nose. Like I wasn't sure. I kind of expected that. I was not expecting this, which is not that. Nicolas Cage is a man whose pig has been stolen. And the pig's kind of a big deal because Nicolas Cage is living out in the woods. And basically, he makes a living with this pig by sniffing out
truffles.
Truffles, thank you. That's the truffle word. Pigs. I was going to say mushrooms of some sort. Truffles is the word.
Which I actually had to be educated on this, apparently is a big deal and worth a lot of money.
Yes.
It's like, I was sort of making fun at like the low stakes of the pig, and someone was like, do you know how much these pigs are worth?
There's actually a documentary from last year called The Truffle Hunters, which is actually about dogs that search for truffles. It's Italian. It's very, people loved it. I thought it was very kind of like, I just was not particularly interested, but I thought the truffle stuff was an education. So this one did not come as a shock. So the thing here is that, so Nicolas Cage's pig is gone and now he's angry and he needs to get his pig. And it's not the violent movie you might expect if you have seen the Nicolas Cage movies from the last couple of years. This is way more controlled. It's much more Nicolas Cage with the capital D drama. It is pretty dark. Alex Wolff also plays a pretty important role. And the movie unfolds in ways that I didn't really expect. I don't think it's great as a movie, but I think Nicolas Cage is really fantastic in it. And it's just a really great performance from him. And it is an interesting little movie. Like, it's very sort of self-contained. Surprisingly, it's a movie for foodies, I would say. It's very food-centric. And it's not particularly violent. Like, it does have some moments of violence, which can be shocking because you're not really expecting it through some of the rest of the film. But overall, I thought it was pretty good, just not the movie I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. So my own fault there. I also saw Censor. I don't know if you've seen this one.
I have not, but this is a film that I'm actually pretty excited for.
So this is a Prano Bailey Bonds film starring Neve Algar, who people might recognize from Raised by Wolves. And she had a small role in Mother, Father, Son as well. It reminded me, the setup reminded me a little bit of Peter Strickland's Barbarian Sound Studio, which has a very similar feel. That movie was about a music producer that kind of like goes crazy as he's making an album. And this one is about Neve plays a film censor with a backstory, and things start to happen after she watches this one particular movie. I think it's interesting for a number of different reasons. The fact that it's written and directed by a woman and tells the story from a female perspective. And it's a story that centers a lot and has a commentary a lot on horror movies and how those are censored or not censored, I thought is an interesting angle. And then, of course, it has this personal story that's also interweaved in it. So it does have a couple of levels that it's working on, and I think it's really effective. And it does have, like, it's set in, I guess, the early to mid-80s, just as, like,
during the whole Video Nasties era.
Exactly. And just as VHSs are sort of becoming a thing. So it does make some commentaries that are interesting. It's just an interesting movie that's working on, it's shooting on a bunch of different levels, and I think it does so really effectively. And Neve gives a really, really solid performance. It's not going to be for everyone. It does get pretty violent in moments, but if you like a good horror movie, I'd say that this is definitely worth seeking out.
We're entering into this really interesting era of female-directed genre violent movies. We had, like, a couple years ago, the film Revenge, French film, which was a rape revenge film.
Yeah.
Female director was incredibly violent, incredibly gory. Yep. We got Censor. We have the Palme d'Or winner to come out of Cannes this year, Titane, from a female director, which is, you know, is...
And I mean, and Raw...
sexual, violent, and...
And Raw is, like, fucking amazing. Like, if people have not seen that, you need to dig that up. Like, yesterday, that movie kills.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I love that we are getting, like, this new era of ultra-violent genre films, but they are coming from a female voice.
Yeah, agreed. And this is definitely up there, definitely worth seeking out. On a totally different note, there is a three-part docuseries on Netflix from Garrett Bradley, who directed Time last year, 2 years ago. I can't even remember when that documentary came out now. But she directed this documentary. It's simply called Naomi Osaka, and it's a three-part documentary on the tennis star. And it's a really fascinating character study. I mean, Bradley has a really interesting eye, and she captures great moments. And Osaka is clearly this very talented, very misunderstood individual. I mean, she's only like 21, like 20 or 21. She's super young. And I think people forget that. And this is very much a really interesting look at a young woman who is at the top of her game and also seriously misunderstood. And I thought it was really fascinating. I wish there was more of it, because it kind of ends and you're kind of like, okay, well, I wish there was more. But the 3 hours, it's approximately 3 hours long. The 3 hours that you get to see Osaka is really interesting. And it gives you a really... It's an interesting commentary on sports figures and public figures just in general, especially young ones. And it's also just an interesting look at Osaka herself. I'm not a huge tennis fan, but, you know, it's hard to not know who she is, especially with everything that's going on. And considering that the Olympics are going on at the moment, and there was so much drama about, you know, who she was going to play for and all of that, that fallout. It's just a fascinating documentary. It's really, really interesting. And I would recommend it. I think it's pretty solid. And that's it. Oh, Let's finish. I think maybe this will be the last item we talk about. I don't know if you have any more, but Loki, or do you have more than Loki?
No, I don't. That's,
so let's finish with Loki, because Loki is wrapped, and I've seen this.
Yeah, so the new Marvel series, Loki, which was, I think it was only 6 episodes, so it was pretty short. But yeah, it was an interesting, wild series, which basically just details the characters. Like, he essentially escapes from Endgame with the time cube in the middle of that movie, and this is like the further adventures of him as he basically gets captured by this organization that basically just polices time, and he becomes a prisoner and becomes befriended by Owen Wilson, who's a civil servant inside this organization, to try to track down what is ostensibly another Loki that is running around out there causing havoc. And he manages to track down and find another Loki, who is a woman played by Sophia DiMartino, gets into a whole adventure with her, teleporting across time and across worlds. And it's as batshit crazy as it sounds. It's like, especially as it gets towards the end, and you end up with this world where it's like there's like about 30 different Lokis there in total, one of them played by Richard E. Grant, one of them which is a crocodile, one of them which is a child. It's like, it's pretty wild. It's like you take like the weirdest of the weird comic books in Marvel's cosmic history, and this is the type of logic that this show is operating on, where it is not afraid to just be as bonkers and out there as possible.
I agree. I really liked WandaVision, but this is like my favorite of the Marvel show so far. I really wanted to like Legion. The TV series from a couple of years ago with Dan Stevens, I really wanted to love it. And I thought it was really interesting, but it was just too all over the place. Noah Hawley just, I don't know, his mind works in weird ways, and I just was not on the same vibe. This kind of almost feels like it's like a cousin of that, in that it's playing in the same kind of absurdity with this universe that they've created, but it actually makes sense, and it feels like it's more grounded in the characters, so there's more at stake. For me, this was like the perfect mix of the weird and the great character development that I love. And I was not prepared to love this show as much as I did. I really, 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 really liked this to the point that I saw it twice. I was really taken in by it. I thought it was really smart. It's really well made. I like some of the sort of unexpected twists that it takes. And I really did not know where it was going. And I thought, how are they going to wrap this up in 6 episodes? So I was really excited to discover that, of course, it wasn't a series finale. It was a season finale. Yeah, exactly. It kind of just walks that sort of fine line for me of absurd and just really, I don't even know if it's really smart. I don't think it's a show that's particularly like out there, but I love the way that I like its take on the time, like time and timelines and time travel, and just the that whole science that they've come up with. I thought was really, really smart and really well put together. I'm all in.
And it's all the really, Loki series. It's really fun to see Hiddleston, who clearly loves this role,
yes,
playing of Loki, and he's a producer on the series as well, so he's got his chops like fully in this, but he's having a lot of fun with this character. And like, usually he's able to like ape in a few scenes with Chris Hemsworth, but here he's able to basically be the main through line and gets to do a lot more than he does in the rest of the films. And he's just absolute, like, Hiddleston's always a delight to watch, but particularly in this role as Loki, where he gets to go incredibly broad but also have an incredible level of pathos, it is just a delight to watch him.
Agreed.
And also, for anyone who cares about keeping up with the various timelines and storylines of what's happening in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Loki ends up being a must watch, because it is essentially the last episode is essentially going to be setting up something like about 3 other movies.
Oh my god.
with the Kang the Conqueror character. basically comes as a result of this show, who is, from what I understand, I think he's going to appear in Guardians of the Galaxy 3, and I think he's also the main villain in the next Ant-Man movie.
Oh, wow. Okay. So people... So
you're going to be seeing a lot more of this character. Felt very much like the Fallout games to me, if you're familiar with those.
Yes.
It basically in like this, like a future world, but all of the tech is like retro tech, where it's all like old computers and has like 50s mod, like
panel
design to it. And that's that sort of kitschy.
Very much so.
Older style to it. And like very the entire... much. The entire offices of the, I can't remember the name of it, but the Time
region,
TVA, I think it felt like very kind of like modeled after that sort of
aesthetic. You're totally right.
And it was fun. I think I like WandaVision a little bit more just because I think that that show had more of an emotional impact.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I
watched that show with the kiddo again. And so it was my second watch through her first. And when it got to the end of that show, as Vision goes away, like we had to like pull out the box of Kleenex because we were both bawling our eyes out. And as much as I love Loki, it just didn't hit that kind of like level of emotional impact for me.
No, and I think in that respect, I think you're right. I think on a, not even just purely emotional, I think on a overall, what tells a better story? I think WandaVision definitely tells a better story. For me, I just found Loki more enjoyable. It's more in my wheelhouse.
I can see that. It's definitely a lot more quirky, a lot more fun, a lot quicker to get through because it's only 6 half-hour episodes. Yeah. Maybe a little bit longer than half hour.
But generally speaking, yeah. I just needed that break, that mental break. I really did.
Absolutely. And I like that we're going to get a second season of this because I don't think there's really another place in the films for Tom Hiddleston to have like this kind of room to play with.
Exactly. Yeah.
Except within a Loki
standalone
story.
Yeah, exactly.
A Loki show. I think you kind of need that to get the character, and the character is so much fun to watch.
Agreed. And with that, that was a lot of stuff.
See, this is what happens when we don't record on the reg.
I know, right? Okay.
We watch too much stuff.
We will be more regular, we promise. But hey, there's a lot of recommendations there, so, and a lot of good stuff to watch. And there's some good stuff coming up too. The summer is young still.
Yeah, absolutely. With all the stuff that we've been holding back on is starting to flood out. So we're gonna get all that stuff.
For sure.
I keep waiting to see if there's gonna be a little bit of a bloodbath with like too much hot stuff being released like all at once.
I was shocked when they released the new trailer for Dune that for some reason in my mind, I'm thinking it's coming out at Christmas. And I'm like, oh my God, it's coming out in October. What happened to Christmas? What happened? So
time doesn't mean anything anymore.
No, it doesn't. So I'm like, what else is coming that I have forgotten about that I thought was coming out later? But wait, there's all this other new stuff coming out later. So yeah, it's gonna get insane. Bring on the movies at this point. Even though there have been movies all year and through last year, there were like last year I thought was a very solid year of movie releases. Mm-hmm. This year just feels like it's already been crazy and it's only going to get worse. So stick with us. We will be back sooner rather than later to talk about more great stuff that we're watching because there's always new things coming. Come on by atcpod.ca for links to all the things we watched. And Ash, where can people find you?
You can check me out on Twitter, Fighting the Good Fight, at Ashley Lynch.
And I am also on the Twitters not as often, at The Marina. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with more discussion. So until next time.
See you then.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.